order, members. We're waiting for Senator Cohen, but in the meantime, we'll start with Senator Marty's Senate File 1646. Senator Marty?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Senate File 1646 is a stripped-down version of a bill we've had in the past, and it relates to a fee that rental cars pay, 5% fee, that part of it goes back to reimburse them for the registration taxes they pay. We have in St. Paul a nonprofit car sharing organization meant for people who, for a variety of reasons, don't own a car, usually because they want to reduce their carbon footprint. They will often be people who use transit a lot, who walk, who other things, but occasionally need a car. And so they have a membership organization, 750 members at current time, who pay an hourly rental rate when they want to use a car. And their typical member will use the car about twice a month and usually about 3 hours at a time. They are not in any competition whatsoever with the big rental car companies. In fact, if somebody needs their car, a car for a day or two or three longer trip, they refer them to the rental car companies. And so what this group is a nonprofit group trying to encourage people to be able to rely less on cars. And unlike the typical car owner who uses a car for 15,000 miles a year, their typical member uses a car 600 miles a year. So very much reduced carbon footprint. And they already pay in Minnesota, in St. Paul, they pay 13.45% in combined sales tax, and that includes a 6.2% rental car tax. Because they're not a rental car agency, we in the past had asked to get out of that 6.2% one, but recognizing the budget situation, we're simply asking if they could be exempted from the 5% fee, which if you look at the fiscal note, would bring in about $17,000 a year, but because their registration tax is about $7,000 a year, the net cost to the state would be about $10,000 a year. And again, other bigger, the rental car companies, the fee becomes substantial, but because they have high registration fees, they turn over their cars, they buy luxurious models, they tend to buy small, stripped-down cars. So they collect a lot higher percentage. They use a lot higher percentage of their 5% fee to offset their registrations. Our car is using more than half of the our car fee would go back to the state, so it would be a cost to the state to do this, obviously. But we think that this is totally different. We want to encourage this kind of use. It's not in competition with the rental car companies. And I'd like to introduce Chris Dufferin, who is head of the Neighborhood Energy Connection, which is the nonprofit energy group in St. Paul that started the organization and now has 19 cars.
Senator Marty, if they only have 19 cars and they've never paid the fee, how would revenue know to put a revenue impact on this?
Because, Mr. Chairman, they are expanding. They will have 21 cars soon, and at 20 cars is the threshold, and they know by the revenues the group takes in that it would be, I think they said, $340,000 per year revenue they take in, and so they calculate the fee based on that.
Currently, they're not paying the fee.
They are not, because they've been too small, exempted, because it only covers car companies over 20 cars.
Your witness, Senator Marty?
Mr.
Came all the way down here this morning. We should give you an opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Chris Dufferin. I'm the director of the Neighborhood Energy Connection in St. Paul. We're an energy efficiency service organization. We do a lot of work on home energy efficiency, home energy audits, energy rating services, home energy financing. But we also offer a transportation energy efficiency option, which is called Our Car. It's a car sharing organization that started 4 years ago and is now in 17 locations in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And the way it works, we have members that sign up with our organization. They pay a monthly fee. They receive a key fob that allows them to scan into the car, use the car. They pick up cars based on their reservation, and they return those cars to the same spot that they picked them up in. And then membership fees cover all their expenses, including gasoline, insurance, maintenance, and this allows our members to save a lot of money on fixed costs of car ownership. As Senator Marty mentioned, we don't compete with a car rental service. We provide a choice other than car ownership. We're not a rental car company. We're membership-based. People enter into a contract. They pay an hourly rate. They access our cars 24 hours a day. They can access them, and they're linked to transit nodes. So when we survey our members, we find that the majority of them bike, they walk, or take transit every day. And then they, when they use the car, they trip chain. They do several errands at once in these cars so that they're cutting down on their car use. So our members drive a lot less. This is helping the state meet its carbon reduction goals that you set two years ago in statute. And that's the purpose of car sharing, really, is to create a convenience so that people can drive less. That's the idea. Our members are all local, unlike car rental service. They're all living here in the Twin Cities, including some in suburban areas that commute into the city and then might use a car during the day. And the majority of our car members make less than $50,000 a year. Despite not being a car rental company, as Senator Marty mentioned, we're taxed like a rental car company. We pay 13.45% in taxes. That's the combination of sales taxes and other local taxes combined with the rental car tax of 6.2%. And this bill won't change that at all. We'll continue to pay the 13.45%. That's 80% higher than what a car owner would pay. The impact would be, if we were to be exempt from that portion, would be $20,000 a year, but we're not asking for that. We understand the budget situation. But what this will do is exempt us from that 5% fee in the future. I think the Department of Revenue made those estimates, Mr. Chair, based on a conversation they had with my program director about where they thought we would be in a few years. And so that was their estimate, their best guess of the budget impact in a couple of years. But there will not be any immediate budget impact as we don't pay this 5% fee right now. The 5% fee is a collection that we would have to put on our members. We'd have to charge our members, and then we pay you the difference between that and our rental and our tab fees. And as Senator Marty mentioned, we have lower tab fees than a lot of car rental companies, because even though we have a very efficient fleet, we have the majority of our fleet is our hybrids. They're fairly basic models of those hybrids, and we tend to hold on to them longer. So while the 5% fee might make sense for a rental car company, it creates a level playing field amongst those rental car companies. They each charging that 5%. We're not competing against rental car companies. In fact, if somebody needs a long-term rental, we refer them to a rental car company. We're just competing against individual car ownership and trying to create a convenience for people so that they can take transit and have an occasional use for a car. So those are that's all I have, Mr. Chair, and I'll take any questions.
Mr. Dufferin, are there any car rental companies kind of on a similar size as you? I'm just kind of wondering, Senator Marty, why we didn't just raise the number up to 24, why we took this approach.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, I don't know if there are small rental car companies would fall in that. There is a I think there's a for-profit car sharing organization in Minneapolis and so on. They haven't been asking for this. I actually think that because they're doing what we want them to do in encouraging less driving, I actually think we should be have been asking for the reduction in the 6.2% rental car thing, because they're just not one. But I don't know of any other types of things like this, and that would be an alternative. But again, they grew very significantly, especially during high gas prices last summer. They're hoping, I mean, their point is to grow to help more people be able to live without cars regularly.
Is anybody from the department here? you can tell me if there are small, do we have small car rental companies? Well, Senator Marty, we'll try to find out.
Okay.
Senator Scoy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dufferin, just because I'm curious, what is the annual membership and what is the hourly fee?
Our current membership is 750 members, and people will pay either a $5 a month fee or a $15 a month fee. Depends on what rate plan they want to go on to. So the person who pays the $15 a month fee pays a slightly lower rate.
And the annual cost, Mr. Chair? The annual cost? You said there was an annual membership?
Mr. Chairman, it's either $5 or $15 a month. And the rental rate, if you have a $5 a month thing, is $8 an hour plus 25 cents a mile or something like that. And if you pay the $15 fee, you get $6 an hour, so a lower rate. But again, the average use is 3 hours. So we're not talking. It's somebody who decides they're going to do their grocery shopping and get to Menards or wherever they need to go for errands, and then they use it all there. People do not keep these cars overnight. It'd be a lot more expensive to do it that way than using a rental car company.
Thank you, Senator Marty.
Any other questions, members? Senator Marty, we thought transportation did not want to see this, and now we just heard that they might want to see this. But we did get them to commit that they would tell us before the end of the hearing here today.
Okay.
So we'll know whether it needs to go to them and we need to do a committee report or not. But right now, at this moment, we don't quite know. So.
Okay.
So we'll just Chair lays 1646 on the table, and we'll take it up a little later today and see if we have to send it to transportation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We either have to take Senator Rest or Senator Cohen, and I don't see Senator Cohen in the room. Senator Rest?
I think I'm next.
Senator Rest, you're up. Senator Moore, what are you doing over there?
What am I doing over here?
Yeah.
This is where I sit.
Are you working or?
Well, you know, the
or
Senate.
Playing solitaire over there.
No. The Senate gives us these nice little computers so we can be more efficient.
How can you see that little one?
Well, I'm nearsighted. Is that what you call it?
You're not old enough to need these yet. That's the thing.
Oh, I'm getting there soon, Mr. Chair.
Senator Rest, tell us about Senate File 1274.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I would like to just let you know how much I enjoy being back on the Tax Committee. Senator Scheid and I are very fond of tax policy and the opportunity to talk about it with the members of this committee who each come with their own perspective and experience is it's just a genuine pleasure as a member of the Senate, and I thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 1274. I have long had ideas about what would improve Minnesota's tax system and was pleasantly surprised, quite frankly, when the two big studies that were presented at the beginning of the of session picked up on ideas that I had rather in a vague way, quite frankly, in terms of what their impact would be on the economy in Minnesota, and fleshed out those ideas. And so what I did was to look at what it would take to reframe Minnesota's tax system, particularly to have it be friendly to the growth of jobs in the state, also to balance out the burden on the income tax, to provide some stimulative effect in the sales tax system, and in general, to realign our state tax system that would reflect a 21st century approach to revenue generation. We have been stuck, I believe, in a tax system that reflects the economy in the country and the economy in the state from the 1960s, and we have not gone and rethought our tax system regarding the monumental changes that have taken place in our economy. I do not propose with this proposal to raise any revenue, although obviously some of the things in it could be used to raise revenue, but the point of it was to be revenue neutral. A second goal was to begin to eliminate some of the distortions in the tax system that had been identified by those two study commissions, and to increase the efficiency of our tax systems. I mentioned before to all in looking at the income tax system, particularly with regard to the tax incidence study, to balance the burden for the personal income tax more fairly, and to recognize that broad-based consumption tax with lowered rates offers the opportunity for more transparency in the tax system, to also increase the stability of the tax systems overall. I have been working on this and making some amendments, and for the purpose of having the proposal in front of us, Mr. Chairman, that reflects the revenue estimate, I would like to offer those the amendments now, and then just to discuss the elements of the proposal as a whole.
Senator Ress moves the A2 amendment. Senator Ress, you want us to just put it on, and then you can walk through the bill?
Yeah, and then I'm just going to go through the bill,
On the A2 amendment. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
After no motion prevails, A2 is adopted. Senator Ress?
I believe there's another amendment as well, the A3 amendment.
Senator Ress moves the A3 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author wants it. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. A3 is adopted. Senator Ress.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. One of the things, by the way, that the bill does not do, except for one kind of cardinal principle that I have with regard to property taxes, I do not deal with a state and local government relationship or try to move that forward with the exception of the repeal of levy limits, and I feel like I want to put that on every bill, any kind of a tax bill that I propose, because I think that it is a great distortion of our tax system, and we should not promote it or accept it. So it's in here, but it's not the focus of what I was trying to do. There are a number of good things about Minnesota's tax systems. I think one of them has to do with property tax, and that is that we do not tax personal property, unlike many states in terms of their property tax on or the tax that they place on heavy machinery as part of their property tax system. We don't do that. Also, I think the leadership that this state and its not only the legislature but the Department of Revenue and the streamlined sales tax has been is a really good feature of Minnesota's tax system. I took seriously the recommendations, particularly of the Millennium Group, with regard to the corporate income tax. I do believe that the corporate income tax falls on workers and it falls on consumers. And I noted in the governor's proposal that he takes the corporate income tax rate down but does not eliminate it, and I think that we should be working toward eliminating it. It was too expensive, as you might well imagine, to do that in 2 years, but one of the features of this bill also is to start thinking about a four-year planning and to really look out to the next biennium and the way in which any kind of proposal that comes forward has an impact on the obligations that we would have 4 years out. The corporate franchise rate of 9.8% is reduced to 7.35 in 2010, 4.9 in 2011, and 2.45 in 2012. And so, therefore, in fiscal year 2013, the corporate franchise tax is eliminated. Again, this change, in my mind, benefits Minnesota consumers and workers who bear the burden for the corporate income tax through increased prices of goods and services, and workers through increased wages, or decreases in the prices of goods, and workers through increased wages. Preliminary estimates, I believe, indicates that in this biennium that would amount to just over $400 million. The state general levy seems to me to be an appropriate place for businesses as entities to make their contribution to Minnesota's economy and all the things that we value that government does for us, most especially education. The target levy then for commercial industrial property for taxes payable in 2010 is increased from $802 million to $1.003 billion, resulting in a net revenue increase of about $250 million per year once it's fully implemented. The amount of the state levy for CI property is indexed as under current law, and the state general levy for seasonal recreational property is held constant as under current law. And then there is a carve-out for property that amounts to it's that 70% rate that is in the regular property tax at about $150,000. The sales tax, in the sales tax area, as a benefit for businesses, Senate File 1274 provides an upfront exemption for capital equipment purchases and repeals the June accelerated payments, removing two distortions in the sales tax system. The first one benefits manufacturers of all sizes. The second one, mostly retailers. Preliminary estimates indicate that change, if you want to follow along on the revenue estimate, amounts to the June accelerated payments, and it also includes other taxes that have to pay those accelerated payments as well, of some $228 million in FY 2010, and then there's a residual cost that is ongoing. The exemption for capital equipment is some $75 million over the biennium. I believe that change also benefits all Minnesota businesses, but mostly manufacturers, but including those mostly smaller entities who fail to file for the refund for the sales tax on capital equipment purchases because of the complications of the refund applications. So I believe that these two provisions leave dollars in the hands of Minnesota businesses during times of economic upheaval, and they could take place immediately. Although this is not a proposal for actually stimulating the economy now, at any time that we get rid of the accelerated June payment and the and provide for the upfront exemption, we will be providing a stimulus for Minnesota businesses based on the time value of money. The effects of broadening the base, which happens later in the bill, and lowering the sales tax rate will also benefit Minnesota businesses. With regard to the individual income tax, 1274 does indeed create a fourth-tier income tax rate at 8.75, starting at $250,000 of taxable income for married persons who file a joint return, and similar increases would occur in other filing categories. The change would be phased in for tax year 2009 and fully implemented in 2010. The preliminary estimates that I received indicated that about 2% of Minnesota married filing joint pairs, there are about 54,000 of them, would have an average tax increase of about $2,000 in 2009 and $4,000 in 2010. Keeping in mind that $250,000 of federal taxable income, I don't know what the average increase to get at a notion of what their general or their gross income would be, but I would imagine at that level there's about, including exemptions and mortgage interest and state taxes paid, whatever, charitable contributions, that there's about $50,000 more of income, gross income. So say people who are earning or have a family income of $300,000. There has been a lot of discussion about how the affluent pay less a percentage of their income in the individual income tax than do and state and local taxes, period, than do the overwhelming majority of taxpayers, even though, of course, we know that people are paying more dollars. But there is a balance and a tension, it seems to me, between the percentage of income and the actual amount of dollars. And it's up to us to find what that best balance is. And it seems to me that it occurs by having a fourth tier to balance the burden fairly. And as you know, the current third tier is 7.85%. Next, the state sales tax. Senate File 1274 does indeed broaden the sales tax base by, first of all, extending the general sales tax to clothing effective January 1st of 2010 and to legal services and accounting, bookkeeping, and tax preparation services purchased by consumers effective July 1, 2011. All of this is being balanced out to try and get to a revenue-neutral position. Unfortunately, with one feature that I brought in to the individual income tax, I was not able to get that rate below below 6%. If you recall, the Millennium Group suggested that in getting rid of the corporate income tax to try and make the choice of a business organization indifferent to the tax consequences as far as possible, that get rid of the corporate tax, but also allow those entities that choose to organize as S-Corps, LLCs, and partnerships to have a 10%20%. I provided a 10% pass-through deduction of that business income, which I believe also has a mitigating effect on putting the fourth tier at 8.75, because it does recognize the value of business income in stimulating job growth. We hear from economists that moving to a broader sales tax base helps reduce the volatility of sales tax revenues. And the suits index we heard when that report was presented indicates that the imposing sales tax on clothing does not increase the regressivity of the sales tax system. And otherwise, of course, the burden falls more on the affluent who spend more on clothing without any increased utility. However, in addition, this proposal offsets the sales tax paid on clothing by lower income people by having unfortunately, according to the revenues description up, another line on the form, which we try to avoid, but nevertheless, a line on the form that would avail lower income taxpayers a $30 credit per adult and a declining amount per child. The credit would be fully phased out as household income exceeds 200% of the federal poverty guidelines, and for a family of four, the credit would be $105, and the income phase out would start at $44,100 and end at $54,000. The sales tax rate would be first reduced from, and I'm only talking here because it's too difficult to take in all of the local option ones. The sales tax rate would be first reduced from 6.5% effective January 1st of 2010, and at the current presentation of the bill, the rate is only able to get down to 6.147. And with the other changes, it actually, and this is a flaw in the bill, in my opinion, goes back to 6.3%. But I didn't know the impact of these changes until I saw the revenue estimate. And one of the ways in which that could be mitigated and to have an actual lowering would be to have the phase out of the corporate income tax occur over 6 years rather than four. So I think it's still able not to increase that rate but to continue to decrease it, balancing out the other things. The also, the proposal calls for a four-year budget cycle rather than the current two, which is why everything in here is extended to see what the tails are, both in benefits and imposition of burden. The biggest pushback has come, of course, from the way in which you go about what makes the most sense in going about broadening the base. I, besides clothing, which is the one major good other than food, which it would increase the regressivity rather than be proportional or otherwise, I look to other services because we are a service economy now, and it is time that our tax system recognizes that, and to move away from taxing labor and business inputs, and to become a system that relies on taxing consumption. I think that we should be moving toward that, and I think economists tell us that as well. The choice of legal services is daunting because it is hard to unravel those legal services that are intertwined business to business. That was what was in the first proposal, and I moved back from that to a proposal that had been in an overall expansion of the base from Representative Portman's bill of last year, and just included consumer purchases, individual purchases of legal services, and the same with accounting and bookkeeping and tax preparation services, which also lessened the revenue impact, obviously, by doing that, even in the estimate. Are those the two major services that that we should look to first in terms of base broadening on consumption? I think that the jury is out on that. I think there's only a couple of states that tax those, but they seem to me to be also ones that were less regressive in nature. Some others have suggested that instead of going there, that even more progressive would be to impose a tax on the sales tax as a broadening measure on brokerage fees. That would get us away from those who would say that putting a tax on legal services is putting a tax on misery and divorce and all those terrible things that apparently we always need lawyers for. I don't think that a tax on brokerage fees is a tax on misery, quite frankly, although maybe right now it is. Who knows? But
so unless the rates of return are so bad, it probably wouldn't matter.
It probably wouldn't matter. Anyway, Mr. Chairman and members, that is the proposal, and I appreciate the opportunity to just have a discussion of it with you.
Senator Rest, I appreciate all the work that you've put into this. Does the proposal, you anticipate the proposal does anything to reduce the volatility of our of the state's overall revenue stream?
Well, I think when you get when you start getting rid of distortions, you have a stabilizing effect. I think the corporate income tax is a very volatile one. We know that 80% of we tend to think that small businesses now don't organize as corporations because the third tier individual income tax rate is lower than the tax rate on corporate income. However, the effective tax rate on corporate income is something like 2 or 3%. We know that when we get a property tax run, we look at not what the nominal rate is, but what the effective tax rate is to really understand what the impact of increases or decreases in the things that we do to the property tax system, what that's going to be.
Senator Rest, what things?
So I think the corporate income tax, getting rid of that, is a stabilizing feature.
So what factors go into that corporate rate going from 9.8 down to 2.0? I mean, what are the factors that make that net rate so much lower?
Ability to take the kinds of deductions that we have,
like depreciation,
in our tax system that are not particularly available in other states when they tax corporate income, and the definition of what income is.
Mr.
Langseth.
You know, I hear so many people say that the corporate income tax is paid for by the consumer. I never hear that about the individual income tax. Most businesses pay the individual income tax 7.85%, and it tends to be large businesses that pay the corporate tax and smaller businesses pay the 7.85. Why is there this disconnect that somehow the public pays for the corporate income tax, but I never hear it about this, the highest rate of individual income tax?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Langseth, one of the statistics about the corporate income tax is you want to really be concerned if you choose to be a C corp with liability provisions that are not so shielded in the other forms, although they are shielded to some extent except for partnerships. But the 80% of C corps have payrolls under $500,000. 96% of C corps have business worth of under $5 million. So it is a popular way for people to organize their businesses, and it's not just the large ones. Although we just expect and accept that someone like 3M or IBM is going to organize as a C corporation, but. But that's a huge number of businesses in Minnesota, and I don't. Let me see if I brought that chart here. Yeah, here it is. in terms of there are 39,000 C corps that organize as that have less than a half million dollars in payroll, and out of about 48,000 C corporations, there are, on the other hand, there are 48,000 out of 50,000 partnerships that organize that have less than $500,000 of payroll. There are 81,000 out of 89,000 at that same level. So it is obviously a very popular way, even among those that would pay 7.85 on their personal income, 9.8 on the corporate, because the rate is misleading. The rate is more misleading on the corporate income tax than it is on the individual income tax, which is why when people talk about we have the highest rate of, you know, in the entire civilized world, that is a or next to highest, that is a that's a pretty phony statistic.
Senator Skoy.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Rest, to kind of follow along with what Senator Langs has said about the individual income tax and the business component, businesses that pay that, would you talk about the 10% pass-through that you have a little bit? And is that some recognition that some of that small businesses that pay on the individual income tax are passing their
exactly.
costs through?
Precisely that, Mr. Chairman and Senator Skoy. It's an attempt to balance the benefit that would be given organizationally to getting rid of the C corps with those that choose to organize otherwise, and that would be paying probably that higher rate again, 8.75 in this system, that it would be recognizing the way in which those business entities contribute to job creation in our state. And I don't know that it's a precise balance. Some of the features here, quite frankly, are just intuitive, that, you know, what makes sense and what made sense to me in listening to the reports and you know, combing through them for things that, you know, given... Are setting aside the terrible times we're in, that those features would be good ways to begin rebalancing and a reframing of our state tax systems.
Senator Rest, the bill summary says that your fourth tier goes to 8.5 in 2010.
8.5. Then
so the 8.75
sure
is.
I guess I was.
I'm just wondering which is right.
7.85 to 8.5. It's not. I was confusing the third and the fourth.
I'm just wondering if the bill summary might have been wrong.
Yeah, to 8.5.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Rest, I think earlier this year we had somebody here, and they were talking about regressivity and volatility. My recollection is that their point was that as you became less volatile, you also had the inverse reaction that you might also become more regressive.
Mm-hmm.
And have reduced some of the volatility, have you analyzed your regressivity or progressivity, however you want to talk
about
it? Senator Rest, do you have any idea what happens to the Suits Index?
Yeah, I don't, Mr. Chairman and Senator Skoy. The Revenue Department has been really good in working with our great Senate Counsel and fiscal folks, but I haven't asked them to make that particular analysis of the bill. And again, there's just some intuitive things about it with reducing volatility, increasing stability. I would agree that is a that leads to regressivity. And we know that our whole tax system, we're told at least, is slightly regressive or at best proportional. And at this point, it seems that proportional throughout all the systems, it is a good goal if we can't get to slightly progressive. But the income tax system is certainly the one in which we value progressivity. And, of course, with the property tax is a funny animal for us because although we have a number of ways of giving property tax relief, we give it through aids to cities so that cities can provide a general level of service throughout the state independent of their property wealth. That's kind of the attitude that we have toward our schools as well. We also have we have a value on home ownership, and we've always had that, and we benefit homes over any other type of property along with agricultural land. And then thirdly, we give property tax relief to individuals based on their income relative to the taxes paid. So you can find a homeowner that is making $30,000 who has lives in a home whose value has been there for some time, who lives in a home whose value has increased to maybe $175,000-$200,000, living in a suburb, paying a couple of $1,000s in property taxes, except the PTR gives that person $1,000 back. So their burden is very much reduced based on their income relative to the taxes paid. We don't often hear about that because most people, even if they deduct their taxes on their Schedule A, they never say a word the next year about their property tax refund as income to them on page one of their 1040. They put their state tax income tax refund, but they kind of forget about their property tax refund. But it can be considerable mitigation of the regressivity, overall regressivity of the property tax system, except that it's invisible because it's hard. You can have this total amount, but you can't go from taxpayer to taxpayer and say what the impact is on them. So we just guess on that. And the same thing is true with the renter's credit, although you know we've seen the governor's report and the Minnesota Revenue Department's report on if we truly are to respect the renter's credit as something other than a housing subsidy, but instead a reflection in the same way for homeowners as for renters, respecting them equally, that we should be reducing the percentage of rent that is the surrogate for property taxes relative to income and the amount of tax break we want to give to that.
Senator Rist, do you have any idea what the department's assumptions were relative to extending the sales tax to the legal services, to the accounting? Is there an assumption that those services are going to absorb that cost and then we'll have some reduced income tax collections, or is there an assumption that they're just going to pass the sales tax through onto their clients?
Well, when you see the economists' graphs about supply and demand and where you get the point of equilibrium, that when you add a tax component, there's some dead space. Because it can't always be moved forward, the entire thing moved forward onto the consumer. So there's a little black part in there that is just the business or whatever individual has to eat that. But for the most part, the sales tax is. Is obviously move forward to the consumer. I think that sales tax is also a very transparent one. You see it every time you make a purchase. It's a constant reminder of what the good costs. And I would suggest that, you know, somebody who goes and buys a pair of jeans at the thrift shop for $10, that $10.65 or $10.60 does not seem to be a huge burden at that point. But it's very, very obvious as opposed to other taxes that are collected. And you know, the regressive taxes that we have, the most regressive in my mind is the Social Security, because you stop paying it after a certain amount. And what is it, $100,000 or so? I've never gotten there, so I don't know. But the excise taxes on cigarettes, on liquor and spirits and wine and beer, those are exceptionally regressive.
Senator Rest, do you have any idea what the property tax impacts are on CI?
The only tax, the only property tax that is addressed in this proposal is the state property tax. So they, and that goes up $250 million. I was able, by putting up with the help of Mr. Paulson, by putting in that percentage exclusion to keep to move only $2 million of that, as opposed to $20 million if it was just across the board, would be a burden on property that was valued under $150,000. So, we do that in the regular tax system too. So, that was another attempt to lessen the impact on Main Street businesses.
I thought I saw some levy language in here though on CI property. What was that about?
Where are you looking?
Section 2.
Oh, that's what I was talking about. That 75% of that first tier would be excluded from it, so that the impact is not felt on smaller businesses.
Senator Squid?
She just answered.
Okay.
So there you have it, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Langseth, you going to have any accountants or attorneys left in Moorhead?
That is my concern. It's very easy to jump across the river, particularly in a situation where all you need is an office. So I'm a little concerned about that, too. They, in North Dakota, they were talking about eliminating the sales tax on clothing, but when it came to the Senate vote, it was 46-1 against it, so I guess we're okay there.
Part of it is having, it, you know, in the competitive part of the issues is making sure that, to the extent possible with our base broadening, to have a competitive rate relative to our neighbors. With regard to impacts on the Mall of America, for example, which is usually brought up for the clothing one, clothing expansion, obviously, there are a lot of things out there that sales tax is charged on already, but I doubt that tourists coming from Tokyo or wherever else tourists come from that are international tourists from London or Paris or whatever, that they come to the Mall of America for not just or they come for the experience as. And probably most of those folks, I don't know how much business that represents, but most of those folks probably do not say, oh, let's go to Minneapolis and because we don't have to pay sales tax on clothing. I don't think that's what motivates people to come in on international flying trips to shop at the mall.
The mall does use it as a marketing tool.
I know.
What are, Senator, do you know what our neighboring states, what their sales tax rates are? I mean, are they all lower than us? Wisconsin's 5.
Sir, I think, in 5.5.
Places
Chairman.
Like, where is Branson? Where is that?
Missouri.
Down there, it's 10%.
the state sales tax?
When you buy something in Branson.
In Branson.
Yes, you pay 10% sales tax. And, of course, you know, states that have that tax food, which I do not see in Minnesota's future at all, because that is such a huge amount of the base, their tax rates don't need to be that high.
Right.
But I don't know. I can't tell you the rates. Maybe the Senate Council or
South Dakota, I think, taxes food, right?
Yeah.
South Dakota taxes food at a lower rate, I think.
But I think so.
I don't know. I know they tax
Wisconsin.
Senator Johnson, you know what Wisconsin does?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, they tax food at 5.5%.
In Wisconsin?
She knows.
Mr. Chair.
But that's another reason to live here.
Senator Langston?
Well, you know, I see these comparisons between states, but that's only half the story. Like Colorado is quite low, but in Denver you pay, many years ago I paid 7.5%. Because the city, sometimes they'll even have county and city sales taxes. So you really have to compare state and local to get comparison. Minnesota has a very high sales tax rate at the state level. But
we don't have nearly the add-ons that some other states
have. In California, I think they raised theirs again now, or they were talking about it anyway, and many of those cities were going to be over 10%. But the state rate isn't near that high.
Quite frankly, we have, in recent years, we have moved toward that ever so reluctantly. Tax for the baseball park, tax on transit, tax for the outdoors, whether it is done by the legislature or done by the voters. I would imagine that if we had if we had allowed the county, Hennepin County, to impose an income tax on its residents to pay for the ballpark, some sort of surcharge, that would have been resoundingly defeated, whether it was a vote of the county commissioners or a vote of the people. People tend to think, wrongly or rightly, that they have control over their purchases, and it's only a little bit at a time. And so it is manageable in terms of how they think about their own pocketbook.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wrong. They don't tax food. They do tax clothing at 5.5. They have a lower alcohol tax also. But they do have higher property.
I'm not sure they even have an ad or alcohol tax like we do in Wisconsin.
I think we have a unique way of taxing it. We don't tax on value. But, I mean, that's why it's an excise tax, too. We tax on the volume. But we tax – I'm kind of getting out of my realm of knowledge here, but I think we tax beer and wine differently from – spirits.
Mm-hmm. Senator Scheid, is that right?
That's correct. We do. I can't tell you
exactly
the breaking points in each one, but it does have to do with volume, and it is different for each of those.
Senator Scheid, would we sell more wine if we sold it in grocery stores? Could we generate any additional revenue?
Mr. Chairman,
a revenue estimate on that bill?
Oh, sure, Mr. Chairman. It was about $9 or $10 million in 1986.
New money.
Yes, new money, Mr. Chairman. You looking for some?
We're looking for new money.
That's what I meant. Yeah.
Huh? Senator Ortberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Rest, I'm sorry if you already addressed this, but what is the rationale for not taxing business transactions in your sales tax on the legal accounting and bookkeeping services?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Ortman, the original bill included all legal services and accounting and tax preparation, bookkeeping services. But in discussions with members of the Minnesota Bar Association, with CPAs, it became very, very clear to me that it was going to be very difficult to unravel some of those business-to-business surfaces to determine the point at which a transaction should be taxed, given that you were trying to do that. And that it was, as one of the principles of a good tax system is administrative simplicity, I chose to do it just on individual consumers because I thought that just led to too many other complications. I mean, people can still say you're still, you know, taxing misery, but I thought that was a cleaner, more administratively simple, and clearly it would be easier to audit.
Senator Orban.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, I want you to know I'm a member of the State Bar Association, and I got one of those email notices that said, click here to say if you oppose this program. I didn't click. I have a bill that is very similar, but I'm concerned about the individuals and the fact that the sales tax might make these services cost prohibitive when we want to encourage these types of services for the professional development of tax returns, and we want to encourage people to get legal services and not to discourage them. So I'm grappling with that issue as well, and I'm wondering if you have some comments about that.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Wortman, I'm not insensitive to that argument. I was looking for those kinds of services that, number one, were not, to begin with, were not at least intuitively regressive. The value of a will that's prepared by a person charging $200 an hour, I'm not sure, for me at least, that it would be any more valid if I had an attorney who charged $800 an hour. So I think more affluent people pay more for their attorneys than less affluent people do, and I'm not sure that that means that they're any less well represented in the legal system. There has been some discussion, on the other hand, with regard to if healthcare is something that we want to provide for Minnesotans of limited means, and I think that's where the legal services argument goes too, that we should, when we decided to do that, we decided not to do it on income, not to pay for it on income tax, but to do it on the provider tax, which has been a source of controversy, but that controversy has generally faded, and we seldom hear people saying, let's get rid of it and trade it for the income tax anymore. And it might be that legal services should get some discussion under the same and look at that particular rubric, and does it transfer into legal services? Should there be a 2% provider tax on legal services and exclude legal aid from that, or pay for legal aid and pay for the courts and provide better system of justice as well as being better funded with a with some sort of provider tax, or is that not a good model? I don't know.
Senator, anything else?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, I think those are good comments and good justification for these types of taxes. I wonder, had you considered adding financial planners and investors? Because I think that they fall into the same category here, and so I wonder why not them?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, I just chose two. As I mentioned at the beginning, probably even more or even less regressive would have been to impose a tax on brokerage fees, because it, even though people of all means would need to write a will, take care of their someone's estate or power of attorney or pay for a divorce or whatever, and that hits people of all means, for the most part, people of lesser income are not investing in stocks and bonds, and that might have been, quite frankly, that might have been a better place to go. What I was trying to get a, not go to, however, was something that would be immediately seen as regressive, and that would be like, and it's a lot of money, is sales tax on automobile repairs.
Senator Rest, I think we have a number of people who would like to testify on your proposal.
Well, let them have
it. Let's see how enamored they are with it. We have a list. Kurt Jurgensen.
Sorry.
And Sharon Jensen and Deborah Thompson. Welcome to the Tax Committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Kurt Jurgensen. I am a CPA from Hutchinson and representing the Minnesota Association of Public Accountants as past president and current chair of the Legislative Committee. I want to thank you for the opportunity to come here today. Senator Rest, I thank you for your change this morning in your bill. I wasn't aware that it kind of changed my whole present, my whole thought of what I wanted to talk about. Was a big change, a good change. Thank you.
Yeah, I was going to say an improvement. I hope you.
Yes.
Is this the pass through?
No, this was the change consumer. In the accounting services as it relates to the trader businesses, if you will. However, MAPA, our association, represents CPAs, registered accounting practitioners, and enrolled agents throughout the state of Minnesota and a few out of the state of Minnesota as well. And very important to us to address this, as it does have an impact on the whole state of Minnesota. As our client base that we're talking about now with this recent amendment to the bill changes, it's important for us to take a look at, first of all, what constitutes a trader business. Is it? And the question I would have, Mr. Chairman and Senator Rest, does it go to just a self-employed business owner, where it might be a Schedule C business, an agricultural business that represents a farm schedule on an individual return? Does it also reach to C corporations, S corporations, and partnerships? That would be a kind of a clarification question I would ask for. When we talk about those types of services, our particular firm has eight members in its staff, and two staff and six professionals. And in dealing with a firm of our size, we do approximately 1,200 to 1,300 individual tax returns, most of which have some type of a business, rental property, investments, what have you. But we also have a number of individuals who are retired, elderly. I'm going to say most of our clients are not making six-figure-plus income and would be impacted by this bill. There was a question earlier, I believe, that someone had posed to would this be a pass-through type question? I apologize. I can't remember which. Okay, thank you. And I'm going to say I can't see that a firm or a tax preparation service business is going to absorb that. It's going to get treated very similar to walking into the grocery store or walking into the auto parts store and buying your product, and it's something we collect, we turn around and remit it into the state of Minnesota. In reviewing that, I think it's important that we look at the fact that we are representing not just business, not just middle and upper income type taxpayers. We're representing everyone, and from lower income to individuals that are up to middle income and upper income, it's everybody across the board. And we do believe that this type of tax is not something that's going to be a well-received impact to the practitioner community. at all. Again, I apologize because I kind of caught off guard on my presentation with what I had wanted to say because a lot of the change with the bill has happened. But it's interesting. We do have a significantly difficult sales tax system in our state. Again, being in practice for over 20 years, I'm very familiar with a number of sales tax audits and so on where this is taxed but this isn't. For example, we have a gravel company client that when they go and deliver a load of gravel to a location, if they drop it and leave or drop it and spread it, it's one sales tax, one is not. You know, the complexity of it's very difficult. I'm 100% in favor of simplification. I think it could be something that could be, you know, throughout the entire system. Yes, do we sales tax clothing? Do we not? Giving a credit for a sales tax on clothing to the lower income people. Sure, if an individual works harder to makes more money, and we're going to spend more money, we're going to pay more tax, and so on. That's a given. On whatever that might be. I think it's an important thing that if we can, through this process, certainly try to streamline the sales tax. I would like to address the corporate tax part that is in the proposal also, and that as an association, we are not in favor of a reduction in the corporate sales tax, or excuse me, the corporate tax rates, if you will. To pass that along, to keep it revenue neutral, feel it's being passed along to the consumers, that sales tax, or the sales tax is replacing the corporate tax, it appears, from the outside looking in. And I'm not sure how that would be perceived, if you will, to the state of Minnesota. From the overall general discussion of it, appears on the outside looking in that we're trying to sales tax the individuals and pulling away from the corporate, and I'm not sure how that's going to be perceived. By adding on sales tax for whether it's tax services, whether it's a bookkeeping and accounting services, whether it's legal services, how do you differentiate that in our tax in our firms? The sales tax for a small business that has those business schedules, whether it's ag or non-ag. That it very much complicates, that very much complicates the reporting of it. And it's something else that keeping track of this being taxable, not being taxable, doesn't make it any simpler.
Mr. Jurgensen, did I hear you say that the society has a formal position against reductions in the corporate income tax?
The Minnesota Association of Public Accountants is not in favor of a reduction of the corporate tax. Not the CPA, not the Minnesota Society of CPAs. This, okay. We're a different organization.
Okay. I'm a little surprised to hear you say that you're sure that the sales tax would be added on, because as I look at the department's analysis, it looks like Senator Rest is proposing to tax about 6.6% of accounting services that happen in Minnesota. That seems like a pretty small amount of the accounting services that actually are performed.
And I'm gonna estimate just with inside of our own firm, I'm gonna estimate approximately 40 to 50% of our tax clients, if you will, not non-business now, but 40 to 50% of those clients are going to be. An average of, let's say, $350 to $400 a tax return, and that's going to get passed along to that consumer. They're not a Schedule C type business or a farm, a Schedule F farm ag business. I'm assuming trade or business would fall into those categories. That's a point of clarification would need to be, but if that's the assumption, again, 50 to 60% of our returns in our firm are business-related in some form or another. The rest are non-business, and that is a fee that would get, or a tax, rather, that would get passed along to the consumer.
So it must vary significantly by firm.
I think so. I mean, I think there are firms that don't, but I also at the same time representing a lot of the smaller firms, if you will, it's like a sole owner type of firm. We have a number of them within our local area. And, you know, they're going to have a percentage of that as business related also, returns that they do. But I'm going to go out and say I'm going to guess that they also have a significant number of returns that are W-2, itemized deductions, and so on. Both one husband or wife or both spouses working out of the house somewhere, itemized deductions, want to have the return done prepared. And whether it's a $200 return or what have you, at 6.5% or 6% or whatever the rate would be, they're going to pass that along to that consumer.
Any questions of Mr. Jurgensen, members? Who would like to go next?
I'll speak. I'm Sharon Jensen, and I represent the Minnesota Society of CPAs. And I would like to thank the committee for the opportunity to speak on behalf of this bill. I also commend Senator Rest for her work and her openness to receiving comments. I think it's been a long-standing relationship with the legislators on the CPA's part in trying to develop good tax policy. Although in our review of this, we do have some fairly major concerns that we'd like to share with you for consideration of how you vote on this and perhaps even further amendments to the bill if that makes sense. I'll speak in broad points for essence of everybody's time here. We're concerned with this being counter to good tax policy, primarily around the fairness and the equity of the tax with the amendment of exempting trade business transactions. You have significantly shifted the tax burden from business or sharing of business to the individuals. Not only have you shifted with that amendment, shifted to the individual consumer, primarily the lower to middle income consumers will be the ones that bear the brunt of this particular sales tax or expansion, in the fact that they are the ones that do not have businesses that will be bundled or billed as a part of their individual tax preparation. So I think we have a significant impact to the consumers in picking up the burden of the relief of the corporate tax. Now, we are not in opposition of the relief of corporate tax and would like to come to some kind of amenable resolution to having good sound tax policy here, but the equity of the regressiveness of this tax, we are concerned with that on the individual consumer. The simplicity of it, we're also concerned with. When you take the type of work that CPA firms in the state of Minnesota perform, most of the larger firms and medium-sized firms work primarily with business clients, of which you've exempted their transactions. So you're stepping down to the sole proprietors who handle a lot of individual returns, and they also, you're stepping down to the low-income people who primarily use people that prepare tax returns as a side business out of their homes during the tax season. Those people are ill-equipped to collect and remit sales tax. So we believe that the non-compliance of the actual remittance and collection of that sales tax will probably be significant, again, raising the cost of administration for the collection of those sales tax dollars. We're concerned with the adverse effect on the small businesses and emerging businesses. Primarily those businesses that are startups or small business are mom-and-pop, rural-type businesses, even some in the metropolitan area here. Our Schedule C filers, our agriculture people, our Schedule F filers, those schedules I'm speaking about are filed on the individual return. If there isn't real clarification around the point of, are those particular schedules within the individual return non-taxable? If so, then that requires the practitioner to break that tax return apart in the fact that he has some non-taxable and some taxable transactions that he has to deal with. I believe that that's going to be extremely difficult for our firms to do. I don't know that compliance will be high in that area. So it is also an additional cost to those people that are in the economic climate that we operate today, struggling to make ends meet. There's economic development and competitiveness issues for the larger firms. Depending on where you define the point of service, where is the sourcing? In the mobile society, in the global society that we operate in today, we do not just work in the state of Minnesota. We work across state borders, into numerous states, and into the international market. So where do you define the taxing point is of significant concern for the CPAs. I'll give you an example that I currently myself am operating on. I am contracted to a company that headquarters out of Detroit, Michigan. They happen to have an office in Minneapolis, and I have spent the last 7 months in Europe doing the contract for them. So where you define that point of service of taxation a lot of times is going to be significant. The larger firms that maintain offices in bordering states like Wisconsin and Iowa, it's going to be easy for them to move their tax preparation ability, also tax preparation ability for both businesses and individual taxes are outsourced to international companies now. In defining how we're going to collect this tax and at what point do we tax those returns, I think we have a lot of logistics, I'll call them, in understanding how that tax is going to roll out and the impact to the individual clients on that. I think we may see some movement of jobs out of the state, movement of firms perhaps out of the state, which is not what we would like to see happen with the economic and the competitiveness of that. The administrative compliance on this, I believe, is going to be significant in how it is enforced, not only as a governmental cost, but to a cost to the businesses that are actually performing this work. And with that, I'll let you answer questions, or I'll let my colleague, Deborah Thompson, make her comments.
Ms. Thompson?
My name is Deborah Thompson. I am representing the Minnesota Society of CPAs. And a lot of the things that have already been mentioned, of course, and I'm more of the numbers person as far as statistically and looking at how many individual filers and tax returns are prepared by professional tax preparers, is there's about 60% that are prepared by preparers nationally. This is by the National Tax Association. Here in the state of Minnesota, those numbers continue to reflect that, where on the individuals, 60% of M1 returns are prepared by professional providers, and of the lower income, the PR returns, 55% of those are prepared by professional preparers. So this puts a disproportionate burden then on those that, because of the amount of percentage of dollars that they would be spending for the tax preparation or for the sales tax, it obviously emphasizes the amount of regressiveness of this tax. And speaking about some of the other issues with regards to simplicity of the tax, in order to talk about how you're going to administer that, there's the various different accounting services, there's tax preparation services, but in today's environment, you have a vast majority of services that you provide to individuals besides that are considered more consulting or tax advisory services. So the line and the definitions of all of these various different issues get very skewed. I think at this point there's a lot of the different points that have been made, and if you wanted to ask Sharon and I questions, that would be fine.
Well, you're well aware of the budget problem the state has, and I think the challenge we're having right now with the governor is getting to a point of defining what the depth of the problem really is. The governor in his budget has proposed what he calls an appropriation bond that he scores about $983 million, about $1 billion. That's new revenue. And he's pulling it from future budgets into this year. So the governor has about $1 billion of new revenue in his budget. And he doesn't call it a tax increase, but it is new revenue that's not here today. And we're looking for revenue. He has a little over $600 million of new property taxes in his budget. So I would argue the governor has about $1.6 billion after he makes his cuts of new revenue in his budget. And so we're trying to figure out if, let's say we agree with the governor that that's the number, that we need $1.6 billion to resolve this next two-year budget. You work with taxpayers every day. Just your personal opinion, and you don't have to answer if you don't want. Your personal opinion, where do you think the most angst is? I mean, we've got proposals around to expand or increase the sales tax, go to the income tax, maybe some combination of maybe a surcharge like was done in 81 and 82. Do you have any thoughts about where taxpayers are at? I mean, let's work from the assumption we need to find $1.6 billion. Where do you think the least angst would be on the taxpayers' part? Just a personal observation, if you wouldn't mind sharing one.
I'm all in favor of let's open up the markets. Somebody commented earlier, and I apologize, I couldn't see everybody who was talking, but somebody commented about putting the beer and the wine and the liquor in the grocery stores. Very quickly over the last weekend, I was in Phoenix, and you can't walk into a drugstore, you can't walk into a grocery store, and their end caps are lined with alcohol. There's a tax there, and I'm not advocating that we want to go out and get everybody all liquored up, but but you know, there's opportunities out there, I think, and allowing for some of those things to have happen. Whether it's sales tax, if a business is going to go out and buy product, it's going to pay its sales tax. It's going to get its tax deduction, but it's still generating more sales tax. You're not looking for outside sources from out of the state of Minnesota, ordering online and all that kind of thing. I think in the last few years that the state of Minnesota revenue, we've gone through a significant number of sales tax audits, and the revenue officers there have said we're getting to the point where we can't generate much more anymore. We've been allocated dollars to go out and generate X number of more dollars in return, if you will. Well, we're finding out that, you know, people are finally catching on for the most part of our very complex sales tax system. And maybe there's a better way to do it, and that is that there should be more sales tax on certain areas, if you will. Whether that's legal and professional, okay, then should it go to the real estate commissions? Should it go to the investment people, as it was discussed earlier? At what point does it stop? Does it go to the medical? I'm not exactly sure what that answer is. But there are certain areas, I think, from a consumer standpoint, that we open up other products, if you will, into other areas. And allow for what's our current liquor tax? 9%, I think.
The problem with that is if there are only so many dollars the consumer is going to spend.
Right.
I mean, and liquor on Sunday is kind of the example. There's a bill floating around it to allow liquor sales on Sunday, but is it really going to sell any more liquor? I mean, do people just buy more on Friday and Saturday so they have enough for Sunday? You know, I mean, there's only so many dollars people are going to spend. So,
Mr. Chairman, I think I personally look at it at the standpoint, if I'm at the grocery store, whether it's a local one or a chain store, whatever, it doesn't matter. If I'm at the grocery store, I may not make the extra effort to drive over to the liquor store to pick up a bottle of wine. If it's at the grocery store, I might pick it up because I'd like to have it for tonight.
Mr. Chairman, I need
Did
his
you
card.
Pay him?
No, I'm not looking to run it for, no. No, but I mean, I think that there's the opportunity is there for some of those things. And maybe this isn't the best example, but it is an example. I think that there's other areas that we could look at.
So is there any appetite for higher income taxes?
Higher income taxes?
Oh, higher income tax.
I mean, if we have to find $1.6 billion, I mean, where would we kind of cobble that together?
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chairman, I understand your predicament. and unfortunately, I don't have the quick answers for you. But, the one thing you want to consider, I believe, is that consumers are in a retractive spending mode. So discretionary spending, such as increased tax on alcohol, I'm not opposed to that, but I would be careful as to how much that really is going to generate because of the economic climate that we are in today. I think most consumers recognize we have significant budget problems. Overall, I don't know that they would be that opposed to an increase in tax. Given this particular circumstance of the climate that we're in today, I don't know that the consumer is going to be all that enamored with the relief of corporate income tax and the shifting to the burden of them only. Although I understand the intent around that and all of the ancillary gains that you can have by doing that, competitive and economic growth and job growth, et cetera, I'm not sure that this is the right moment to make that move. Unfortunately, I'm not the one that has to make that move, but I can see where there would be significant ramifications or concerns from the individual consumer with that move at this particular moment in time. I mean, we've had many discussions over the years of equalizing the Minnesota state tax with the federal tax so that we don't have as many discrepancies, and primarily a lot of movement hasn't been made in those areas like AMT because you can't afford the lost revenue and we have no way to make that revenue up. And we have budget deficits that we're trying to cover. It's a tough situation.
Ms. Thompson, you want to get in?
Thank you, Senator Buck. I think one of the things that I've noticed amongst the consumers is, no matter whom I talk to, that there's a large amount of angst. Most people, whether or not they've been laid off, are in the fear of being laid off and are reducing the amount of their spending. I think January was the first month of, and I don't remember, 14 years where we had consumers that were actually saving more, about 5.5% compared to historically what it is that they had been saving. So they're definitely retracting the amount that they are spending. And some of those different things I think we need to take into consideration. I think the biggest thing that I've noticed, it gets back to the same thing, is things that are going to create job losses or that are perceived to are going to create job losses, such as the sales tax, are what creates the most amount of angst. It doesn't give you the answer, but I believe that so many of them, because of the losses that they've incurred, the different tax rates where you have in the city of Minneapolis, where you've got the Hennepin County, the constitutional amendment tax of 3.75 that'll come in July 1st. You've got the Hennepin County rate and all of those taxes that are adding on. People are feeling very burdened by both the income tax as well as the sales tax in a time when they have less to spend or are spending less.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
But, in my proposal, that sales tax rate would go down. Now, not as much currently as I would like, but the base broadening allows for a reduction in the rate. Also, just a comment about the administration. It's the first fiscal note I've ever received on a tax bill, but I did get one from the Department of revenue, and they indicate that they would only need a quarter-time attorney to, so the cost in 09 would be $25,000, and then they need a full-time person in FY10 for a cost of $76,000 to administer the change in the sales tax and answer all the questions and so on. So the Department of Revenue, at least, as the way I read their fiscal note, indicates that that particular part of it would not be a daunting challenge. And whether we do it on legal and accounting services in terms of base broadening or clothing, I do think we have to keep in mind that the Department of Revenue is very sophisticated in its ability to make sure that taxpayers know what their obligations are. And they don't indicate that they're going to need, you know, eight new auditors in order to, or attorneys in order to figure out a base broadening that would come in some other way, like the brokerage fees, or Senator Ortman mentioned financial planners or something like that, that there is a straightforward way, at least from their fiscal note. It's not a big burden.
Stir the pot. Ms. Jensen, any thoughts about how we could increase the participation and payment of the use tax? I mean, our it seems like there's quite a bit of money there, and there's a lot of tax avoidance going on. Is there anything you think the legislature could do to right now it's kind of a voluntary thing, and we don't get a lot of participation. Is there anything we could do to improve that? We all pay more because people are buying things out of state or online.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct, and that is one of the concerns that we have with the way this bill is written now. The people that have the capability to go to another state to have their work done would be then, you would be shifting that to the use tax level. They would be the consumer would be the actual one that has to pay the use tax on those services. We all know that the compliance on use tax is not very high, and I don't have a really good answer for how you can increase the compliance in that area, because you're primarily going to the consumer level, and the consumer or individual is not inclined or is not equipped to be filing use tax. I think maybe one of the areas you could look to incorporate it to would perhaps be the state income tax that they file. If we had a section or something on the state income tax forms that addressed use tax for out-of-state purchases or something of that nature, you may get a higher compliance by that route. But individuals are not, they don't think about how they should report use tax. And if they are not a part of a business organization that already reports sales tax, it is quite onerous on them as an individual consumer to take the time to file the sales tax report. So I think some avenue of attaching something else out there that they already file may be beneficial to a higher compliance. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts?
I know from my accountant, every about the end of the year, I get a four-page form to fill out. It's just a reminder to come back to them and have them do my taxes again. There's all kinds of questions they ask on there, and you put in some numbers. But I'm just thinking about it. Nowhere in there does it say in his form, did you buy anything out of state that might be subject to the use tax or something. So, well, I don't think he's ever
Mr.
asked.
Mr. Chairman,
me.
there is a de minimis amount
$700
that you don't have
something
to
like that. But no. I don't ever remember him ever asking. So I'm not sure we're making much of an effort in that area. Senator Johnson?
Mr. Chairman, totally off the subject, but to your question about where do you think there could be a revenue source, Since you've been the tax chair, we haven't had this conversation, but we could have a private casino in the state.
Senator Johnson, would that, back to my point of there's X number of dollars in the economy,
Mr.
people
Chair.
Are going to make spending decisions. If they go to the private casino to spend money, what do they not purchase?
Mr. Chair, I did hear you say that, but I also heard a discussion about taxing alcohol and kind of proliferating that usage. I think that the other piece, the gambling piece, is going on, and maybe if it was privately owned, we would get more revenue out of it. Right now, we're not getting that much revenue from that going on in our state.
Senator Scoy, you on the list here?
My question is a little different.
Good.
You kind of danced around the tax issue, but you know, if my accountant was looking at my business and my revenues and my operating expenses were out of line, he would be telling me that I either needed to cut my operating expenses or increase my revenues. And when you're, you know, a farm, it's kind of hard to increase revenues when you're cutting expenses, but you do the best you can with it. I don't think that one of the solutions that he would recommend to me is to borrow money for this year's operating expenses. And I was wondering if you guys would have any advice to us about that as a solution to our budget, because one of the things on the table this year is to use the future payments to borrow this year against those future payments for this year's operating expenses of the state.
Okay.
You guys ask tough questions.
Yeah.
Well, that's a, and it, I mean, it's a serious problem, and
it's
really what this session is going to kind of boil down to. Are we going to borrow money out of future revenue that, you know, we're anticipating we receive and pull it forward to help balance the budget and, you know, ignore, you know, the future hole that you may make? Senator Ruttman?
Mr. Chair, just a quick comment on that, and then I'd like to go back to the sales on legal and accounting services. But we just had a bill just the other day about giving the cities the power to borrow against future revenues. And so I think we're saying they should be allowed to. I think we should be internally consistent on that position.
Well, but Senator Ortman, the issue there is where we committed revenue to them and then don't pay it to them. You know, and they have their budget set with our little piece in there, and then we claw back our piece, and now they have a big hole in their budget that the state created.
And, Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, it was for 2 years, which is different than 20 years.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think everybody's looking at all different sources. It's the same thing with the Met Council saying that they're going to pull back their right-of-way acquisition fund. They're going to take from the Livable Communities Fund. I think everybody's looking for sources of funding to get through the next biennium, which leads into my next point, which is...
Senator Ortman, before we leave that point, if the governor would commit to me that he would not cut aids and credits through an allotment for the next 2 years, I have no reason to put that provision in the tax bill. I mean, I'd be happy to shake hands with him. If he agrees not to unallot aids and credits, then I'm all for this. I don't think the cities need that additional debt instrument. But if he's not willing to do that, we don't know how much further south this economy is going to go. I'm not as optimistic as you are that we've hit the bottom yet. But anyway, moving on, Senator Ortman.
Well, Mr. Chair, like I said, everybody's looking at all different sources of funds, and I think that's just another one that's on the table here. Coming back to the tax on legal and accounting and bookkeeping services, I agreed with the comment that Jurgensen made, that this bill altogether looks like, because you're taxing from those that are having individual or are participating in individual transactions, you're taking a sales tax, collecting it from them, and basically subsidizing the reduction in the corporate business tax. I think it really looks like that. It might not be the intention of the author, but it does look like that. And
I, for one, think that if we're trying to raise revenue because it's a priority, we shouldn't then be spending money on policy preferences like the corporate reducing the corporate business tax. I think that looks like a preference. And internally, the bill raises $1.1 billion. I think if we're going to raise $1.1 billion, we should very carefully consider what spending we engage in with that new revenue. Do we really want to make policy shifts, or do we want to engage in putting that money into the budget? I do have one other point, and I can come back to that if Senator Rest would like to comment first.
Sure. But,
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wortman, the bill is a reframing of three major tax systems, and I think it is unfair to single out one and say it's paying for the other. You could just as well say, forget the sales tax on legal and accounting, and you could say, well, it is the individual fourth tier income tax bracket that is paying for the corporate break. Or you could look at any of the others and say that. Or you could say that, we don't want to reduce the sales tax rate. We wouldn't want to do that. And we're making businesses pay for the reduction in the sales tax rate on the statewide property tax. I don't see how you can just take one element and say that it's the one that's bearing the burden of a decrease otherwise. And the notion that we hear from economists over and over again that the corporate income tax is a tax on consumers in higher prices and on workers in lower wages. So the notion of getting rid of the corporate income tax at the entity level is somehow borne by is a boondoggle for all these big impersonal entities is just is false economics, and we don't hear that from any economist.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Rest, what to the point that some of that corporate tax burden is shifted outside of the state?
Well, Mr. Wilson, who's here, Dr. Wilson from the Department of Revenue, said that we have to make a distinction between the corporate burden as it's felt in the current system and the tax incidence for a change in the system. And a change in the corporate income tax, particularly in relieving it, accrues to the benefit of Minnesota residents, something like 90% of it. The change in reduction accrues to Minnesota residents. Now, maybe intuitively, that seems a little bit strange, but that's what the note on that said back with regard to my proposal.
Senator Orton.
Mr. Chair, and to your point, Senator Rest, I don't think I used the term boondoggle. I think that reducing the corporate tax.
Well, some people think that it's impersonal and therefore it's not something that people who think of business as some overlord that they don't deserve a business tax break.
Senator Rest, with all due respect,
let's try to go through the chair.
Yeah, sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair. I've never said that. I think that reducing the corporate tax is a good thing. It's the timing of it this year that I'm disturbed about. I don't think that in an economic crisis we should be cutting the corporate tax rate and raising taxes on income, raising taxes through a sales tax to pay for it. I just don't think, whether it's coupled with other provisions or not, I just don't think this is the year for reducing the corporate tax rates. I think it's a good plan. But I did want to ask about the pass-through. We talked about for small businesses. We talked about for limited liability companies, for partnerships. We had that recommendation from the Tax Commission.
Right.
And I'm wondering what the panel might think about that as if there would be more fairness if we were raising the sales tax on these types of transactions, but at the same time putting an exemption on pass-through income from those types of entities. The recommendation from that group was 20%. If you do that tax, that pass-through exemption, it would it would benefit not just the groups that would pay the sales tax, but it would also benefit all the other small businesses, all the other sole proprietors. It would create, I believe, economic stimulus, because those are the first people to create jobs in an economy like this. So I'm wondering if any of you have thoughts about that, about exempting pass-through income as opposed to reducing the corporate tax rates.
You want to give it a shot?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Orman, I'll try to – point of clarification.
Ms. Jensen, go ahead.
You're talking about exempting all pass-through income from their business to their individual return, or the 10% offset that is in the bill?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, it would be a 20% exemption on all pass-through income from all sole proprietorships, from limited liabilities, from partnerships, all of that, and S-Corps, all pass-through income that's taxed on an individual basis as opposed to as a corporate basis. I think that we should probably have a cap on the amount that you can exempt, but I think that we should be looking at that as a part of any expansion of a sales tax on accountants, lawyer transactions, financial planners, brokerage. I'm wondering what you think about that.
Ms. Jensen?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, it would go a long ways in offsetting if we continue with the exemption of trade or business services. That would go a long ways in offsetting to make them whole, so to speak, if you compare that with the reduction or the phase out of the corporate income tax. It goes a long ways in equaling the playing field, so to put it in layman's language. But I'm not sure it makes them whole, but it would be a good step in the right direction to helping reduce or minimize the impact to them individually.
Senator Squad.
Thank you. And Senator Rest, you just said that 90% of the benefit of the reduction in the change in the corporate franchise tax would accrue to Minnesota residents.
Yes.
Now, if 40% of the tax is paid by non-Minnesota residents, which I think we heard something close to that this year, and you go to zero, the math doesn't work.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Skoy, when the exported burden was reported to the tax committee, I asked the Department of Revenue, how do you assess a change? And do you assess a change in burden or lessening in burden differently from the a static point in time burden? And I was told, yes, you do. And I blink just like you're doing because it intuitively that did not compute with me. But the analysts in the Department of Revenue indicated that was the case. And so it seemed to me that was a valuable thing to start doing. And I also point out that the pass-through is not on in the bill and or recommended by the Millennium Tax Group is not is only on those the pass-through income that comes from partnerships, LLCs, and S-Corps, because those entities are not taxed on their net income. So it's not on individual proprietors.
Senator, it's kind of the Senator's choice part. I would be surprised.
I know.
If we zeroed out the corporate income tax, if the price of a 2x4 at Menards went down, I just would be very surprised.
Right. Well, looking at their at the page where they talk about that, their claim is that at this point, of course, our maximum individual tax rate is 7.85. If we excluded for them their proposal or suggestion, 20% of the pass-through income, if we were able to do that, would enhance Minnesota's competitiveness with other states by dropping the highest marginal rate on those earnings and we're talking now that, you know, we're getting to effective rates, not nominal rates, to 6.28%, or 23rd highest in the nation, as opposed to 11th highest in the nation. And they claim that the research indicates that higher marginal tax rates on pass-through business income increases the cost of capital and discourages additional investment and hiring by entrepreneurs. That even when new investment or hiring occurs, higher tax rates decrease the amount of capital investment, the number of new jobs, and total wages paid by those businesses. A 5% increase in a marginal tax rate resulted in a 10.4% reduction in the number of entrepreneurs making new capital investments and reduced the amount of any such investments by almost 10%. It doesn't seem on its surface to be common sense, but it is what the economic research shows. And in this proposal, again, it's a whole proposal. It's not just one thing. That seemed to be a good thing to include.
So, Jurgensen, then we're going to cut you guys loose because we've got a couple other people who want to testify.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, just kind of as a follow-up, when I first started talking, we talked about our association not being in favor of eliminating of the corporate sales tax or corporate tax rates. I still feel that way, but a reduction in, I think, is a very positive step towards. You had asked us the question a little while ago about what other avenues could we look to try and generate these dollars. And I think a reduction in, absolutely. It's encouraging. We have one of the highest corporate tax rates in the country, and encouraging a reduction
in
that rate.
But not effective
rate. Pardon me?
Never mind.
Okay. And encouraging of a change in that rate, as well as a flow-through reduction from the S-corporations and partnerships, LLCs, et cetera, is a very positive thing. I do believe personally that the sales tax on the clothing, if you will, start with an exemption amount to the individual income tax returns, even though it's adding more processing to the return of the M1, is a positive step. We're looking to try to figure out a way to generate more. A number of other states, I know there was a discussion earlier about, does Wisconsin charge food? Number of sales tax on food. Number of states do that. And so as we look to areas of, there may be avenues to try to come up with like those in a manner of, and still allowing for opportunities to give credits or exemptions on the returns back to lower income people. You asked for different avenues. Those are possibilities.
It's interesting, members. I met yesterday with a very, very successful Minnesota businessman, and he's got manufacturing plants all around the country, probably 10 of them. And he just closed his one in Florida. He said there's just no way Florida's got to be the worst place in the country to do business. Closed it.
What?
They have no income tax, but...
Right. Sales tax.
In
tax on
workforce.
Intangibles.
Workforce. No problems, he said.
Mr. Chair, there was a business in Minnesota many years ago that they started at Branchstone in one of the southern states. And the idea was they're going to be shifting more and more of their business down there because the taxes were cheaper and everything. They began scaling it back after a while down there, and they asked why, and they said we had production problems. Well, the production problems were the workers weren't anywhere near as productive as they are in Minnesota, and this was in northern Minnesota. So there's a lot of things that go into the business decisions, and I think our rather energetic workforce is probably the strongest thing we've got going.
Senator Limmer, you know one of the things he told me was?
Okay.
Is they were advertising for employees for their manufacturing facility. And because they pre-hired drug tests, they couldn't even find applicants in this economy. Couldn't even find applicants because they pre-hired drug tests in Florida.
So are you advocating that you take away the drug test, Mr. Chair?
It's a pretty interesting, you know, we hear the governor talk often about our tax climate, it's our problem. There are a lot of problems in states, and I mean, Minnesota's done pretty well, and it's been a lot about workforce. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Members, we got at least two other people, Sharon Van Dyke and Michael Ford. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Sharon Van Dyke. I am the current president of the Minnesota Association for Justice, which is a group of attorneys, plaintiffs' lawyers primarily, who represent consumers. All of our clients are consumers. And I'm here to speak in particular with respect to the imposition of a sales tax on lawyers' fees and some of the concerns that I have on behalf of my organization, but frankly on behalf of our clients, who are people, individuals who are exactly the people that are left in on this bill. And Mike Ford speaks for a broader base of the bar. With respect to the clients that our organization represents, and we're talking about almost exclusively individuals, ordinary people. And they range from someone who has nothing to someone who obviously has a lot. But the vast majority of them would be a good representation, I think, of the demographics of the state of Minnesota, because most of the people in our organization are either involved in employment disputes, and I'm talking about from the proposition of point of view of the employee. They're involved, their family matters, divorces. They are in personal injuries, some of them horrific, car crashes. There are some other areas that our members represent, but frankly, all consumer law. And the reality is that these people can't even access the justice system in this state, which is guaranteed by our Constitution, without a lawyer. I mean, increasingly, there are a lot of people who try and do it on their own. But if you talk about that with anybody in the court system, you'll be aware of the fact that it's extremely difficult. Those people have a lot more trouble getting what they need. They just simply don't have the skills to do it. And the tax that you're talking about on legal services is something that will be passed through to the consumer. Just like it would in any other, just like any other sales tax. Would apply to, the way it's written as I see it, it would apply to any time a consumer comes in to ask about advice about anything, whether it's housing, whether it's, doesn't matter if it's personal, if it's not business, people who are getting thrown out of their homes, people who are all of these ordinary people. Every time they go seek legal advice, they're going to be taxed. And these are exactly the people who can't afford to be taxed. To suggest that this isn't a totally regressive tax is ridiculous, because it is going to be passed on to the consumer. I know that in the personal injury context, with contingent fee lawyers, it also is going to impact, frankly, who can take a case on behalf of someone. It's going to impact how cases can settle or not settle. Because settlement is a function of many things in negotiation, but settlement always represents compromise. And in an overburdened court system, you want compromise. You want people to resolve things outside the court system. You don't want them to go to the court system. It's more efficient. You have to have lawyers to do that. If you add 5%, 6% that has to get paid out of the fee, the cost, the amount of the settlement has to go up to arrive at the same place. That's going to make it much more difficult to settle cases. It's already difficult. I have a private practice myself personally. I'm a sole practitioner. I can guarantee you it's going to impact my clients. And it's the kind of thing where if I know we need to bring in money, I understand the situation. But to do it in this manner, I see it as a way to, that's going to impact individual consumers, many of whom are on the bottom end from the middle down of the income area. People who need legal services a lot and the most and probably can't afford them are going to be the people who end up paying the tax. And my concern is that we're going to be turning people away or having them self-select not to get help that perhaps they need because they can't afford the tax.
Thank you, Ms. Van Dyke. I think one thing is, I think Senator Rest's attempt is for a revenue neutral bill.
I understand that.
Sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mike Ford. I'm a civil trial lawyer up in St. Cloud at the Coonlevin Hughes Law Firm. I'm the president of the Minnesota State Bar Association, which has got about 16,000 of the 25,000 lawyers registered to practice law in Minnesota. This is a difficult appearance for me because of the respect that the Bar Association has for Senator Rest and her work in this body. She has authored many bills which we have supported. Unfortunately, this is one as it relates to legal services that we cannot, but we do it respectfully and with a certain amount of caution because she definitely knows her work. I came here to talk about three things, but I don't know that you need to hear about them all, but I'll just mention briefly what they were, so if some of you want to ask me some questions about something I don't dwell on, I'll be able to respond to it. One, I was going to talk about the connection between this bill and funding the legal system. I've been told there is no connection, so I'm not going to dwell on it. But I will talk about it if somebody wants to talk about it. I also came here prepared to talk about the misery tax portion of this. And other people have talked about that, and you've gotten letters and probably emails that you don't want to get that talk about the misery tax. And I'll talk about that if there's some time to talk about it. Instead, I think I'd like to focus my remarks on the third thing I came to talk about, and that is whether or not this bill is ready for prime time. Because I think that's something that this body expects attorneys who appear in front of it to tell us, well, if we pass this bill, you know, what's the problem? I mean, can we do it? Is it right? Is it ready for prime time? So there's a couple of things. Some of them have been talked about. The most glaring, the easiest one to take a whack at is how do you define legal services? We've been fighting over that for years. We had a task force of the Bar Association on multidisciplinary practice because there were so many folks getting into what we figured was the practice of law that we ought to figure out whether we could live with them or we had to fight with them. We had a heck of a time coming up with what legal services were. At one point, somebody wanted to preface the proposition that, well, if a lawyer's doing it, it must be legal services. Of course, the significance of that is we do have an unauthorized practice of law statute in the state, which is never honored and never enforced, and nobody's seriously proposing to do it. But if you were to pass this bill and we started to tax all sorts of folks doing things that up to now we hadn't thought was legal services, maybe that would give a boost to that bill. I'm not recommending that. Another issue that comes to mind is sourcing, and you had a discussion about that earlier. And I have a little bit of knowledge about that problem because my firm does a little bit of practice in South Dakota, which, as you know, is one of the three states in the nation that has figured out that tax and legal services is a good idea. One advantage that South Dakota will always have over Minnesota, at least until you get around to fixing it, will be is that they tax all services. So they don't have to worry about whether it's legal or not. They just tax it. Now, in Minnesota, you're just going to tax the legal services. Then we're going to get into that nice fine line of trying to decide what is this? Is it legal service or is it something else? But the other thing that South Dakota does is they tax a service regardless of where it comes from. In other words, as long as the South Dakota client is getting the service, it gets taxed. So in my firm's case, for example, we had to buy a program and we had to insert it into our software. And by the way, I just as a practical matter, I asked, because I know this was a question people might think of, is this going to wipe out, you know, small firms, law firms, in terms of their ability to comply? So I went to our back office. We have 27 lawyers. We're not a small firm. We're not a large firm. We're kind of in that unhealthy middle ground where you get squashed by everything, by everybody else. And we put that in, and it works pretty good, and it's pretty easy to figure out. It's got these drop-down menus that give you all these options. Well, is it taxable or isn't it taxable? And so I was going on this assumption that, well, if I was calling up my client in South Dakota and talking to her and giving her this legal service, but I was in Minnesota, that wasn't taxable. But I went across the line to take a deposition or participate in a trial. Since I was in South Dakota, it was taxable. I was talking to Ms. DeConcini, who's the vice chair of our tax section in the Bar Association, getting ready for this. And she pointed out to me, well, you got to pay that tax regardless of where you are. So luckily, I went back to our business office to find out that despite we had all these drop-down menus, we paid the tax on everything. So I saved myself from that perspective. That's one of the challenges that lawyers are going to have, and clients are too. I don't know how you're going to do it, because you can do it two ways, as I understand, at least Ms. DeConcini tells me. You can't do both ways. One way is you tax the service where it's provided, in other words, in Minnesota. The other way you tax it is you tax it based on who provides it. Okay. If you do it the first way, you tax it based on where the service is provided in Minnesota, you get certain disincentives for businesses and lawyers. If you do it the other way, the disincentives turn around. So you're going to have those issues. Beyond that, I should mention in my background way back about 20 years ago, I was the president of the Minnesota Defense Lawyers Association, which is the analog or the opposite to the plaintiff's lawyers. We represent or hired by insurance companies and so on and so forth. One of the interesting, intriguing things about this bill is apparently if Allstate Insurance Company is able to hire my law firm, although they don't hire us, they hire other lawyers, but that's why I'm using them for this example. If Allstate Insurance Company pays us $5,000 to defend a typical soft tissue whiplash injury case, which is car collides with your rear end, you get a neck ache, you go to a chiropractor, they don't pay us a tax. They don't pay a tax on our service, but they do pay a tax on the $5,000 fee that the plaintiff's lawyers end up charging for the $15,000 settlement, which is a typical settlement in a soft tissue injury case, north or south of that number. But then, here's another thing that'll happen. Insurance policies, and we don't talk about this a lot, they're really contracts. And they're contracts of indemnification. And what that means is that they indemnify the insured, the driver, for his legal fees. We kind of cut through that middle ground, and we don't really indemnify, we just pay it directly. So my question is that a consumer tax, or is that a consumer charge, or is that going to end up being a business charge? It'll be a fascinating question to work out. Something more close to home that we can all understand, Mr. Petters, resident of St. Cloud, currently has problems seeking indemnification, isn't getting it, lawyers are complaining about it. Is his legal fees going to be taxable, or is that a business-related thing? I don't know. Could be interesting. You know, when you negotiate an employment agreement, which happens a lot in Minnesota, as lawyers, people move around, the business gets to not pay the tax, but the employee coming in has to pay the tax. When I first started out in the Bar Association, one of my first events was a Bar Association meeting, and they asked, and they had a complicated issue of no fault that they were thinking about putting through. And I saw that this was going to lead to all kinds of litigation. So I got up in front of the body and I said, you know, I pointed out the problems that were going to be there. And I pointed out that my law firm typically was hired by insurance companies to unravel those problems. And then I paused because it just dawned on me. And I said, upon more sober reflection, I withdraw my opposition to this bill. Of course, it went down to stinging defeat as the lawyers realized we were just going to create more problems. So maybe I should withdraw my opposition to this bill, but I'm not going to do it. The Bar Association is not in favor of this bill, primarily for the misery reasons that we've touched on a little bit. Let me give you some specifics. As part of my effort to come here, I did some talking to other lawyers in the Bar Association. Divorces typically are running about $1,000 to $2,000 for low-income folks. When you get above that level to folks that, and when I say low income, just short of qualifying for free legal services, above that level it runs $5,000 to $30,000, depending on how much you want to fight And unfortunately, in divorces, people sometimes like to fight. And if you really got a lot of assets, it could go as high as 150. So what that translates in for your $5,000 divorce, you're going to pay $325. For $30,000, $1,950. For $40,000, $2,600. And for $150,000, $9,750 in additional fees. As far as the low-income folks, they're only getting whacked $65 to $130, but as we know, there are fees related to that, which right now are running about $240 for a filing fee, but likely to go up, $55 for each motion, likely to go up, translation about $405. So it's gonna be a significant part of what it takes to unravel a family. Child support modifications will run you $1,000 to $5,000. Adoptions, if there's no problems, $1,200. There's going to be some problems, $2,500. And if you've got a real contested and Indian Child Welfare Act issues involved, which in Minnesota is not an insignificant part of our adoption practice, $10,000. Paternity cases, depending on whether they're contested or not and how much is involved, $1,000 to $50,000. CHIPS cases, typically, most lawyers won't touch them for retainer of less than $5,000. That's assuming that you've got the wherewithal, which a lot of people don't, in a CHIPS proceeding to retain a lawyer. Custody and parenting time modifications, roughly about $10,000, depending on how much fighting you want to get involved in. And finally, in the family law area, the question arises, are these legal services? But it's a thing that a lot of lawyers do, mediation. Mm-hmm. Don't have to be a lawyer. In fact, a lot of people who mediate in family law are not, but is that a legal service or not? Parenting time expediting, parent counseling or consulting, and arbitration. Are those legal services? You know, there's an old saying that old soldiers never die, they just fade away. Well, old trial lawyers never die, they just become mediators. Are they going to be charged a legal services fee for that? Don't know. I'm hoping that I get asked the question that the accountants got asked about, well, if not this, then what? But I'm not going to presume on the committee, and I'll just stop and pause for breath.
Well, let me ask, does the bar have, if we can all agree that we need about $1.6 billion in revenue, bar have any thoughts about where we should get that?
Okay. Well, that's something I do have prepared remarks on because I knew that question was coming. And I knew that question was coming because when this bar year started, mine started in July 1, I looked around the horizon. I haven't looked very far, and I said, you know what, guess what? Funding for this legal system is going to be a real problem. We're going to have to stand up and do something that the Bar Association typically has not done, which is go into senators and representatives' offices and say, you ought to fund this system. And sure as God made little green apples, I knew somebody was going to say, well, if that's so, where's the money going to come from? You're a long line of people in here telling us what we got to do in terms of funding. Where are you going to come up with the money? And I knew we were going to be asked that question on sales tax and legal services because even though I know this bill is not designed to raise any money, which I have to say, in this time and age, I got to give Senator Rest credit. Not many people are going to put a bill like this forward and face the kind of meetings like this if it's not going to raise money. But I believe that the final analysis of a sales tax and legal services does come in, it's gonna be to raise money. So I asked that question to the Bar Association because we've been on record for 10 years, more than that, as being against the sales tax and legal services. I even prepared a little written summation of the arguments in favor, trotted it around the table, couldn't get a bite. Nobody was willing to say that, no, we ought to change it, even if it meant problems with funding the courts. And I personally thought that was unacceptable. So I ran another question around the table, and I'll respond to your question, Mr. Chair, this way. The response I will make here in public is the one I've been making for some time in private about something that is apparently and surprisingly off the table. I'm talking, of course, about that progressive method of raising revenue for the good of the state, that system that we have well in place and know how to administer, that process which doesn't unfairly single out one group to fund a program like legal system that the entire society benefits from. And you know what I'm talking about, of course. I'm talking about income taxes. Now, I'm told, and I've been told by senators and members of the House, that we can't consider the dreaded T word because the governor would veto any bill with increased taxes. Well, you know, and frankly, I know, and frankly, the governor knows, that this legislature is most assuredly going to have to raise taxes in order to cover the historic shortfall we are now facing. Why then do we not go ahead and do what we have to do, raise taxes, but do so in a way that the constitutionally protected right of access to the courts is adequately funded without the gimmickry of fees and sales tax on legal services. I believe that if the members of the Minnesota State Bar Association were presented with the choice of increased income taxes across the board at all levels, that in order to adequately fund the legal system versus a hodgepodge of fee increases and a sales tax on legal services, they would vote hands down for a fair and progressive income tax increase. And I think the citizens of Minnesota would do the same thing. And I'll make this personal commitment to you. If that's the route we were going to go, if that's the route we have to go, I will sell that to the Bar Association, and I will get them to try and sell that to their members. Because in my view, that is where we have to go in this state. And I have run that up the flagpole. I have talked to individuals. I've not run committee meetings on it yet. But when I pose it to them in that way, on the one hand, an adequately funded legal system, and on the other hand, a sales tax on legal services, nobody likes an income tax increase. I don't like them. Nobody does. And I think that's what you're hearing from previous speakers. And it's going to be a hard sell. I'm not telling you it's going to be easy. But if you spell it out to the voters in a way they can understand, you do it in a fair way, and you let them know everybody's sharing this burden, just like we're sharing what's going on in the economy, they ain't going to be happy, but they'll do it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ford. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that the State Bar Association has quite a bit of credibility and is very persuasive when it talks about the misery tax. I'm concerned about that, but I don't buy the complexity argument, frankly. I mean, I've practiced law for 20 years. I've practiced and had cases in South Dakota. It wasn't that hard to charge the sales tax and pay it, and I've done it for other clients as well. It's not that hard. The distinction, which I'm not in favor of, but the distinction between individual and business transactions is not complicated at all. You know, Mr. Petters, he's got a criminal case. That's individual. Obviously, his business has some legal cases as well, and that would be a business transaction. Senator Rust, I might not be in favor of the distinction, but I definitely don't think that it's as complicated as being presented. And I think the State Bar Association would be better suited to arguing about the misery factor and the fact that we've got people in really difficult circumstances that now we're going to have to help pay for sales tax. That's a very persuasive argument. I hope you'll stick to that one.
Was that a question?
Mr. Chairman, I would be interested, it seems a bit ironic that the concern is for the low-income person who needs to access legal services, and yet the Bar Association or this gentleman would not be reluctant by comparison to impose additional income taxes on low-income people because he said he favored an income tax across the board. And so the poor people would pay more income taxes. And I'd be interested to know how different that would be relative to their economic status than paying a sales tax and getting a credit of up to $100 a year for a family of four. Seems like to me that if I was a poor person and needed a will or a divorce, that I might rather have pay that sales tax, get the income tax credit, rather than forever and a day be paying increased income taxes to avoid a broad-based consumption tax. And once again, whether it's legal services or accounting or brokerage fees or whatever else would come into play for a base broadening on the sales tax and lowering the rate. When he mentioned the sales tax that would be paid, he didn't mention the lower rate that was there or the impact on the low-income person who would get an income tax credit on their M1. So I don't mind hearing about the specific parts of the bill, but it seems to me that what we haven't heard is people who have taken the entire proposal and criticized it in its entirety. And I was looking forward to someone talking about that as opposed to, well, what if we took legal services and accounting services out and put X in? and still lowered the rate and still gave a low-income tax credit, would that make it a better bill?
Senator Rest, how about let's replace legal services? I saw the realtors in here with real estate.
Realtor services. Let's go for that. I mean,
either
does that make it a better bill to
Ms.
put
Berger,
something
did you fall
else
on
in
the
there?
Floor? I thought maybe you passed out.
Well, you know, the choice is made because those two services, I made the assumption that the suits index would not show it to be increase the regressivity, and that's where I wanted to look. Certainly, clothing doesn't increase the regressivity. And I chose those two, but you could have chosen anything else. I should have probably said service X to raise this much money so that I wouldn't have people just isolating one element of the proposal. But this is the real world, and you can't just have a theoretical service that you plop into a bill.
Senator Moi.
Ms. Chair, Ms. Van Dyke and Mr. Ford, I have to tell you that I take exception to the characterization of the sales tax on legal services as being the misery tax. And henceforth, I hope that we will cease to refer to it as such, because I would think that if that's the route that you would like to go down in, I would ask us to backtrack and look at the onerous fees and surcharges that we've imposed, which is much more regressive than a proportionate rate on legal services. So I take exception to that. I think that it is convenient for all of us to whip out those poor people and make them the victims of the things that we don't want to do. And you know what? Poor people have got some dignity too. And I think that I represent a lot of people who does not fall into some income brackets around here. And I've talked to enough of them, and at the end of the day, I mean, I think they'll be willing to communicate to us that they're sick and tired of being people's poster cases for the arguments that we want to make. I do take exception to it being characterized as a tax on misery, because that's just not the case. It's a proportionate percentage on legal services all across the board. And if we want to talk about it from perhaps an effectiveness or an incident or a burden perspective, it may disproportionately burden some groups and individuals more than others. We should focus on that. But I think it is irresponsible, and I think it is unfair, but really irresponsible to continue to characterize it as such. You know, I'm a co-author in this bill. I care a lot about what's going to happen to the courts. And I've asked Mr. Ford, and I've asked the courts, and I've asked lawyers who've come before the Judiciary Committee to say, you know what? If you don't like what's being proposed here, this is just doesn't even raise the money that we need. I mean, there might be other bills that are going to be introduced in the next couple of days that might go even further than what Senator Ress is doing here. But the courts are going to suffer a 7% cut. And many of these so-called people that we're speaking on behalf of to oppose this provision are the ones who are going to be left out of the court system with a 7% cut. So I would hope that we would all exercise a little bit of some responsibility as we move forward in these conversations, because I think that it's just not true. It's not an accurate characterization.
Mr. Chair, can
Mr. Ford, we'll give you a minute to rebut, and then I want to see if there's anybody else who wants to testify on the bill.
I'll be brief. My apologies if I gave any impression that the only people who suffer misery are people of limited means, because the misery that I'm trying to address, and I thought I did in my remarks, was anybody who gets into the court system. My family went through my entire youth and up to be me going to law school, never even meeting a lawyer. And I think a lot of people go through that too. They never do. And all I'm suggesting is that those few people poor, rich, middle class, who do have to go into court or need to retain a lawyer, shouldn't have all the costs laid on them. And that's why I was saying, let's spread it out to everybody. So to the extent my remarks seem to be taking advantage of the poor was not my intention. I was trying to point out it's the people who get into the legal system that are being asked to share this burden, this particular tax.
Sorry. Ms. Van Dyke, then we're going to move on.
And I don't believe I ever used the term misery tax, and I did not.
I
did. I don't think he did. Mike did, but I did not. And my point had to do with the fact, and perhaps I did not articulate it well, that legal services for many people, for many things, when they need a lawyer, it's not like an option. For many things, people need a lawyer, whether they can afford that lawyer or not. And I meant to draw the distinction between individuals, and they're of many means, and businesses. And when people need a lawyer for a personal reason, be that family law, be that employment law, be that landlord-tenant law, be that whatever, they need it on a personal level. They are being the ones singled out disproportionately, whether or not they can afford it, to pay this tax. It's not an across-the-board thing.
Ms. Van Dyke, Mr. Ford, thank you. Would anybody else like to testify on Senator Rest Bill?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer, while they're coming up.
I'll hold my comment.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I'll be brief. We support Article 1, the repeal of levy limits, but the issues I want to really raise, I want to raise with you actually are around the sales tax, because as you know, cities do pay the sales tax, and there's three pieces of the bill that I want you to be aware of. Number one, on the upfront exemption for capital equipment, we do support that because cities do build waste or water treatment facilities, and we do pay sales tax on those inputs. You may remember a bill by Senator Bonhoff that tried to clarify that a couple of years ago. We do support this upfront sales tax exemption for capital equipment. Number two, the general sales tax rate reduction, I think, would probably generally benefit cities because we are those sales taxpayers, and those the reduction in the overall rate probably would reduce the amount we pay, given that we don't pay a lot for clothing purchases and other newly taxable purchases. The one other point I'd like to make, though, is that on the Service X issue, if it's legal or otherwise, we do have a carve-out for business-to-business transactions. The amendment does refer to services used in a trade or business, and I'm not sure that clarifies whether cities and counties and townships are in or out of that business-to-business issue, and if your intent, Senator Rest, is to exempt those purchases by cities, counties, and towns, we might want to work on the business and trade.
And Mr. Chairman, I don't know whether, from the way I read the revenue estimate, I don't know whether that the city purchases of legal services or accounting services, if they go outside, are included in the estimate. But I think it's a point well taken. In fact, the elephant in the room on sales tax, besides the upfront exemption and the June accelerated, is indeed the sales tax that's paid by local governments, which we did in a desperation measure, and because it costs so much, we've never been able to undo, but it's certainly not good tax policy.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, I did talk with Dr. Wilson about the scoring of that particular piece, and mm-hmm. I believe that the local governments are not included in the numbers that appear. So the number appears to not be in the scoring
of
this.
So all we need would be to change the language.
But
Mr.
we might
Chairman.
Just need to clarify the language.
Yeah.
Thank you, madam.
Happy to do that.
Mr. Hesse?
Mr. Chair and members, for the
why
record,
would you want to get into this? Because I'm going to ask you that question about $1.6 billion,
I know.
You know.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and I'll try to give my abridged comments here given the time. And Senator Rest, we appreciate you bringing this legislation forward. In its entirety, the Chamber can't support or can't oppose the bill because there's just a lot of different impacts on businesses, and what I think maybe what I'll try to do is walk through each component and let you know what we individually what we support and where we have some initial concerns or some continuing concerns. But there is a lot of good tax policy in this proposal, and I just wanted to recognize that. And even the author's amendment addressed a few of our concerns as well. So we thank you for that. The biggest issue that the business community will have is the increase in the statewide property tax, a $250 million per year increase in business property taxes is a big issue. It's a tax that businesses pay whether or not they're profitable. As I think all of you know, business property taxes are probably teetering around the 10th or 12th highest in the nation, according to the Minnesota Taxpayers Association study. We'll have a new study coming out, I believe, next week, and we'll see what the 2008 numbers are. But that is the single biggest issue for the business community is with respect to the statewide property tax. Second on that list would be creating a fourth bracket, and really there's for two reasons. One, small businesses, S corps, partnerships, and so on flow their business income through a personal return. The addition of the 10% exclusion certainly helps that a lot. As you know, the Governor's 21st Tax Reform Commission suggested a 20%, but at least there's a recognition that as personal income tax rates go up, that does fall on business income, certain structures of business, and so we do appreciate the inclusion of the 10% exemption. The other issue, though, is on recruitment of employees, and businesses tell us from time to time that personal income tax rates do cause them more difficulty to bring some individuals into Minnesota, and so that does remain a concern for us. The corporate income tax, I think if there's ever a tax that should be done away with, it's probably the corporate income tax, at least it'd be really high on the list. And for a couple of reasons that have been talked about previously, it's difficult to administer. It's a volatile tax. It doesn't raise a whole lot of money in the big scheme of things. And it's the high rate in Minnesota is really negatively correlated with investment in the state. So we appreciate eliminating that tax, even if it takes a few years. That's moving certainly in the right direction. On the sales tax, the Chamber has supported for a number of years a base broadening to consumer goods and services in a revenue-neutral fashion. We have not specified individual services or goods to expand the base, but in general, the tax policy that our fiscal policy committee and board have talked about is, and I try to ask them every year, if the base is broadened to consumer goods and services, the rate is reduced, or further business inputs are eliminated from the sales tax base, is that something that you would support? And so far, their answer has been yes. I note in talking to some individual members that if they don't collect the sales tax currently, they're not looking forward to becoming new sales tax collectors. And there are certainly some issues around specific services that have been talked about today. And so the service X is probably a lot easier to deal with than the specifics. And I'd be happy to sit down and work through some alternatives, because I do think there are some complications with accounting and legal specifically. But the addition of the business-to-business exemption goes a long way to address our sales tax concerns. But there still will be border issues, Minnesota and surrounding states, and competitive issues, especially with if you pick services that aren't taxed by a variety of states. Finally, capital equipment and June accelerated sales tax, two things that have been on our list of to-dos for quite some time. The capital equipment is especially important for smaller companies that have to finance the tax payment to the state and then wait for the refund. So that's certainly a cash flow issue there. And I would think if capital equipment and June accelerated can't be taken care of through a tax reform proposal such as this, that maybe along the lines of reversing shifts that future surplus revenue could be directed towards these two proposals, so we can maybe take them off the books at some time in the future. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer questions. And just again, there's each individual member of ours probably has a slightly different impact of this proposal will feel a different impact. But a lot of the policy direction is absolutely correct. We thank Senator Ress for starting this discussion and bringing it forward.
Well, Mr. Hesse, if in the tax bill we were to try and undo the June accelerated and do the upfront exemption on capital equipment, both of which the chair would like to do, and if we tried to do something like Senator Rest is suggesting in reducing or eliminating the corporate income tax, we have to pay for that. So, Mr. Hesse, do you have a suggestion how if the chair wanted to go down that road, how we would pay for those provisions?
Mr. Chair, isn't it time for session?
If you and I could make a deal, we should do those things, Mr. Hesse. If we could find an agreement, we're going to do those things. Can we find an agreement about how we'd pay for them?
Right, Mr. Chair and members. Our board has discussed the state's budget situation and has not endorsed or supported specific tax increases. So I can only relay what our board has supported and which is to try to balance the budget as best you can without increasing taxes, and especially taxes that will negatively impact the business climate. So I'm sorry I don't have any suggestions for you today, but has been the discussion of our board.
We're looking for ideas. Mr. Hesse, has the board talked at all about the idea of four-year budgeting, and do they think it's at all important to try and have a balanced budget in the next biennium?
Mr. Chair and members, they haven't been asked that specific question. We haven't met for a couple of months now, but I would suspect that they would balance, certainly would see it as important, but balance that against the potential negative consequences of business tax increases.
But Mr. Hesse, I just kind of wonder, I mean, from a business person's perspective, if we can cobble together a balanced budget here and leave on the horizon 2 years from now, a looming, I think under the governor's proposal, about a $2.6 billion deficit built in that we know is going to be there 2 years from today. Can any business operate that way, kind of managing from one fiscal crisis to the next? Could a business really make good decisions if they knew 2 years out they got another big hole and you never quite quit managing from one crisis to the next? I mean, that's the question I'd like your board to talk about.
Sure.
I guess I'd be surprised if businesses run their operations that way.
Mr. Chair, and it's a very good question, and I think that's one of the difficulties with dealing with the federal stimulus money is that to a certain extent, if you use it, it delays addressing some of the longer term trends. But if you refuse it, then you're refusing a couple billion dollars worth of money to give yourself some flexibility. So that certainly is a good question, and we can have some conversations about that.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Hesse, and thank you for the comments about the bill. I have a question about the budget, too. The governor, as you know, and Senator Bach had asked others about this, is proposing the $1 billion in borrowing with appropriation bonds, which would cost another $600 million plus the billion paying back. Would your members think that as opposed to an income tax increase, that the issuing of those appropriations bonds makes good business sense?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest.
For all the things that you mentioned, hiring people, the benefits that you receive from the economic climate here, et cetera.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, I think, in general, what I've heard discussions of the appropriation bonds, I don't think there's many that think it's really great policy. I think even the governor would probably say that. My guess is our board and businesses generally would think similarly that it's not great policy. Again, it's the trade-off that you present, and I don't know how members would feel raising personal income taxes versus the appropriation bond. They do certainly have some concerns and have long had concerns with Minnesota's relatively high personal income tax rates.
Mr. Chairman, what Senator about if the income tax, what about a 1.5% increase in the sales tax rate on the current base to raise $1 billion plus? Would that be preferable to the appropriation bonds?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, again, I'm not sure businesses pay 45% of the sales tax, mm-hmm. so we businesses would be paying roughly $500 million of that that increase. Good question, and things that I will try to get answers for in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Hesse, that would be helpful. Senator Limmer?
Well, Mr. Chair, I've listened to a lot of comments today, and I, for one, want to encourage Senator Rest on working on the reform that she's trying to create and then present to the public. We've had a lot of, some unfair characterizations of what Senator Rest is attempting to do. Her plan, although I may not at this point be ready to support it, it's bold, it's fresh, it's innovative, and it's something that I think our state has to consider big plan movements in order to solve our problem. We've got a crisis of the first order, and the way we've tried to patch up our system when we've had much smaller problems isn't going to fix it this year. So I think the innovation that's reflected in the attempt to redesign our tax revenue flow is desperately needed, and I wanted to congratulate Senator Rest for bringing this forward and then suffering a little bit of the slings and arrows. But nothing gets done in one fell swoop here, and we all try to invite as much comment and reaction as possible. But we need to have these discussions, and the more comfortable we get in going through this exercise, we'll solve the problem.
Thank you.
Any other questions of Mr. Hesse? Mr. Hennessy, anything further?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. The partnership in the room? Just want to give them an opportunity on Senator Rest's bill if they're here.
She is, Jill is out of state. I think she may have submitted some comments.
Now that you mention that, Mr. Hesse, she did tell me she was going to be out of state, but we don't believe we have anything. But if we do, we'll distribute it to the committee. Senator Moy?
Do you want me to do Senator Cohn's bill very quickly?
I don't think Senator Cohn's bill will take very long.
No.
And while she's coming up, maybe we can take Senator Marty's bill, Senate Bill 1646, off the table. And transportation has told us now they do not want to hear it. So the chair will lay Senate File 1646 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Mr. Chair, members, Senator Cohen was scheduled to present Senate File 1114 to the committee. He's trying to finish up the Finance Committee meeting, and he's asked me to present it to you. I have with us today the Bond Counsel, Ms. Durseth, to the City of St. Paul to answer specific questions. But Senate File 1114 basically is here to ask for authorization for the city to issue up to $40 million of general obligation or special revenue bonds to finance a facility in downtown St. Paul.
Senator Moy, any idea how they're going to pay for them?
Mr. Chair, I believe that the bill language, and maybe Ms. Durseth could answer the question, but it's going to be out of the city's... whatever the money available to the city or its housing redevelopment authority.
Chair. Senator Bach, committee members, the primary source of security would be if the state loan is forgiven, the payments that the team makes to the city that are used to finance the state loan repayments, those monies would be used to pay a portion of the debt service on the bonds.
So I think if we assume the state's not going to forgive the loan because we probably don't have any resources to do that, do we need the bill?
Potentially, there could be other sources of money that the city would use. It would make it a lot harder for the city to find the revenues to pay the bonds because I believe the city is committed not to using property taxes. They do need the GO, though, in order to make the bonds credit-enhanced and to make them marketable lower interest rate.
And what would be the reason we should authorize the city to do this without an election?
Well, the primary security for the bonds, as I mentioned, would not be tax revenues. But unfortunately, under our state law, even if you are using other revenues to pay the bonds, if you have the GO pledge, there's no exception under our current law to issue those bonds without an election. So the property taxpayers would not necessarily understand when we put it to an election that the bonds are intended to be paid from sources other than property tax revenues.
Good try.
Any questions, members? Senator Skoy.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry I didn't catch your name, but if they're GO bonds and the city has the obligation for them, what other revenue source would you have besides the property tax if you couldn't make, you know, if you borrow them and things don't play out the way you intend, they're going to fall back on the property taxes?
I guess Mr. Hurley, the city treasurer, is probably better equipped to answer that question.
Do you have any idea if anybody would buy these bonds?
With the city's
GO? I mean, if they're not backed up by the property tax,
it becomes much more difficult.
Who's going to take the risk, and what's the interest rate going to be?
Chair Bach, Todd Hurley, I'm the treasurer for the city of St. Paul, also the budget manager. To answer your first question, this type of bonds, this bill is tied to arena loan forgiveness, and these bonds would not be marketable. It would be extremely inefficient, if even possible at all, to sell bonds without a credit enhancement of the city behind these. So that's where we're looking for the general obligation on issuing these bonds for the ICE facility in downtown St. Paul.
Okay, I think we understand.
Yeah.
No. I wonder if Senator Cohen didn't want to come here and present it. Senator Ma, how does he give you this kind of duty?
Mr. Chair, I think Senator Cohen believed that being a valuable member of the tax committee may trump the being finance chair. And so I like to think that maybe that's true.
Senator Ma, the tax committee can probably figure out how to do this bill if Senator Cohen can figure out how to pay for it over there.
That's where I could perhaps do some horse trading, Mr. Chair.
Are you the author on the bill with him, Senator Ma?
I am on 1114 only, I think. Or maybe on the other ones, too.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair, members.
Any questions of the city? It's a tough poll.
Mr. Chair, you know, barely 5 feet tall, but I can carry the city's burdens.
Ice, as it were.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Charlie's over. Senate file 1114 for possible inclusion. Members, Monday we think we're going to have the K-12 bill, and we'll see what tax impacts there are in that, and then we're going to have some local bills also.
Mr. Chairman?
9 a.m. Monday morning.
Did they figure out the impacts of the federal stimulus in their bill? I thought that's what was holding it up last night. Did they figure that out?
They just asked us to tentatively schedule it for Monday, so. This committee's adjourned.